This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A couple of years ago, a 28-year-old Kenneth Branagh directed and starred in an acclaimed film adaptation of Henry V. You might have thought this alumnus of the Royal Shakespeare Company and founder of the Renaissance Theatre Company would have continued in a classical direction with his next film. But he hasn't. Branagh directed and stars in the new movie Dead Again. Critic Owen Gleiberman describes it as unpretentious, garishly, thrillingly vulgar, with twists and turns that never existed anywhere but in old movies, stitched together in an ingenious new way. Dead Again is about a Los Angeles detective tracking down the identity of a woman with amnesia. Under hypnosis, the only thing she remembers is a glamorous musical couple of the 1940s. She and the detective may be this couple's reincarnation. Branagh and his wife Emma Thompson play dual roles. Because of the flashbacks, making Dead Again was like making two movies. One a contemporary thriller, and the other a 40s melodrama, which Branagh decided should be in black and white.
In one version of the script, the scenes were written and described as being shot in black and white. In another version, they weren't. And to be perfectly honest, I wasn't sure. So I talked to the lighting cameraman, Matthew Leonetti, and I said, look, how can we hedge our bets here? And so we talked about doing what eventually turned out to be the case. We shot that footage on colour stock, but we printed it eventually for black and white. And we lit it, in fact, in order to, as you might have lit for black and white, in order to provide enough contrast, in order to give enough shadow and texture to the look. And we tested it so that we knew that, yes, it would work both ways. When we then decided that it was definitely going to aid the storytelling clarity to keep it in black and white, then we experimented with quite how black and white it should be. And I think that starts to answer your question. I mean, once you literally mess around with the chemical bath in which you're printing your stuff, then you can make that black and white a little bluer, a little sheenier, a little greener, a little whatever. And we went for a slightly a blue sheen on the top of it, which I think is in tune with and in keeping with some of the real look of some of those old black and white movies. And that was quite a delicate process that took quite some time once we decided to go with the black and white. But we were always, because we knew that this was a possibility, the choice of textures and the look of costumes and the cut of costumes and the sense of richness, the way the dresses moved and the whole look of the party sequences and the nightclub sequences and the way the material hung, particularly the women's dresses, and particularly on Margaret Strass, was we took a great deal of time over in order to achieve a sort of elegant simplicity that felt effortless but deeply glamorous and highly romantic.
Now, since you play two different roles in the movie, you get to play two different characters: one a European composer from the 40s, the other a contemporary American detective. And so you have two different styles of acting, two different accents in it. Before we talk about your accent, I'm interested in hearing if there was a particular type of actor, a particular type of acting style from the period or from the place that you were trying to get in each.
Well, with Roman Strauss, who is a rather tormented composer in the 40s, who has come to Los Angeles from Germany, where he's been very famous and where he is now trying to write an opera in order to establish a fame equal to that he has found in Europe. He was literally based on some German expatriates, including Thomas Mann and Schoenberg and Bertolt Brecht, who moved to Hollywood just after the war, but also film-wise, based on the kind of character that the more unconventional leading men, often European leading men, of the cinema of the time would have looked like. The kind of Charles Boyers, the Paul Moonies, the little later on the David Nivens, the sort of suave, debonair actors, the ones with lots of eyebrows moving all over the place and slightly pomaded and a little curl to the hair at the side and perhaps a little grey here to look distinguished. We were encouraged by the look of, for instance, Laurence Olivier as Maxim de Winter in Rebecca. We don't really do that, but we're in that sort of vein.
Now, the Mike Church character, the contemporary American detective character, this is a much more loose-limbed, casual type of character you're playing. Mm. What kind of American actor did you base this part of the performance on?
Well, I suppose that it was more based, strangely enough, on the author of Dead Again, Scott Frank, who is the same age as I am and sort of the same size. And he is a Los Angelino, born and bred, and he recorded the part for me on tape so that I could listen to it on one of those little tape recorders. I also, in pre-production, I remember I started it on Labor Day of last year. I went out having spent some weeks preparing with two excellent dialect coaches, Carla Meyer and Susan Hegarty, with my accent, which to begin with had started very East Coast and nasal and mad and over-gesticulatory. And on Labor Day, I finally got the courage to go out to the pictures as an American, and I tried it out. I bought my popcorn as an American, and then I remember buying some books as an American. And that day I started to rather strangely actually walk behind people in the street and in the shopping mall to get a sense of what you just mentioned, this loose-limbed quality, I think born out of spending luckily a great deal of time in the sun, as opposed to us rather cold northern European types who are all a little bit more straight-laced and physically held in.
What was some of the advice that your voice coaches gave you on how to speak American?
Well, I think a key thing was not to was to pay attention to the smaller words, like what, you know. And instead of saying what, you'd say what, and lots of little abbreviated things like that. Not to gesture too much. I mean, I really did start very kind of, you know, overblown and kind of nasal and mad and completely non-understandable. And I literally had to travel my accent across the country. It was like getting on the accent train. And it went pretty much via Alabama and all sorts of places until it really took time living in Los Angeles to hear. What we were trying to go for was a sort of neutral West Coast sound, which I think people fairly rightly think does not really constitute a distinctive accent in the same way as a Southern accent or a you know, Brooklyn accent. But in a sense, it makes it somehow more difficult to do because there are definite sounds, but they're subtle.
I don't mean to ask you to, like, do stunts for us or anything, but would you say a few words for us in the kind of West Coast American that you came up with for the movie?
Well, you know, I kind of feel slightly uncomfortable doing it, you know, because it seems so tailor-made. I feel as though I need Mike Church's jacket on, you know, Mike Church's trousers, and I need to be in his apartment. Do you mind if I don't?
Because it's that's fine.
It's that sort of weird, mysterious acting-y thing, you know, where you know, it's all to do with a whole set of other things, you know, that go with it. I don't understand it, but I respect it.
My guest is Kenneth Branagh, and he directed and stars in the new movie, Dead Again. He also directed and starred in the recent film adaptation of Henry V. I'm going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actor and director Kenneth Branagh is my guest. You know, we're talking about the American accent that you do in your new movie. I think accent has always been crucial for you, having grown up in Belfast. You had an accent when you started acting that would have been considered, I think, unacceptable for a classical actor in England.
Yeah, I mean, the Belfast accent is a very hard one. You know, that is quite, when people speak very quickly, it's very hard to understand because it's very nasal and very got very sharp edges. But it's one that, I mean, I left Belfast when I was 9, so although there were very formative years there, and indeed one feels very Irish, I moved to a part of England that was so suburban and wonderfully bland, actually, that it that after a while it produces the blanded, rounded tones you hear before you.
you write in your memoir that when you got to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in England, that everybody around you sounded like they spoke on the BBC every day, and you felt like you were talking really differently, and you were very self-conscious.
Yeah, it's a very sort of fundamental thing, I think. One's identity as partly defined by the way one sounds. And, of course, Britain still remains riddled by the notion of class and as manifested in all sorts of conflicts between people from the provinces and people from the city and people from different income groups. And you know, one means of telling all that is the way people speak. So it's a... For everybody in England, I think it's an ongoing. One's very aware of it, and I guess in a sense it was very helpful to become an actor, because you are encouraged to produce a sort of neutral sound, a neutral accent, if you like, that helps you get work, because basically potential employers have so little imagination that if you walk in with a strong regional accent and you're perhaps auditioning for a part that requires, say, BBC English, they, on the whole, don't believe you can do it. If you walk in with a neutral accent and you're perhaps auditioning for a part with a regional accent, they tend to believe you can. And so the harsh... employment realities of that meant that we all had to change a bit, and all the more sort of tight-arsed newsreader types had to calm it down a bit, and those of us with slightly more regional brogues had to even them up a bit. But eventually, you know, as an actor, I think it's quite useful to have a sort of rather anonymous voice in a way, so that, I mean, as for instance in Dead Again, one can then have great fun sounding completely different.
Now, you wrote in your memoir that voice teachers were particularly hard on you. Why?
Mm. Well, what happens when you, or at least what happened when I started at drama school, was there's a process of, I suppose you could loosely call it, breaking down in order to sort of build you up again. That is to say that they make you aware of every habitual physical misuse that you may indulge in. So if you have very bad posture, if you have stooped shoulders, if you have, as I had and have, a rather stiff jaw, if you're... the arch in your back throws your stomach out and you don't rest your weight evenly on your feet, and if you have a lisp or you have funny teeth or you have anything that does not allow you to produce what was a favourite phrase of my voice teachers, which was rich, dark, golden brown sound. And if you couldn't produce rich, dark, golden brown sound, they'd let you know that you had a stiff jaw, that your tongue was too short, that you had dark L's, whatever they are, and that you were more or less a physical wreck. And over the course of 7 terms, I think the idea was to... allow you to analyse those things, to be in control of them, to be in control of your short tongue, your dark L's, make them light L's, perhaps, you know, improve your posture, do Alexander technique and all things connected to being a perfect physical specimen. So it was sometimes a painful process, but it was it did indeed do just that. It made you aware of all the things that... our very imperfect bodies sometimes prevent us from doing if we're trying to be amazing acting machines.
So in what way, though, were your voice teachers particularly hard on you?
Well, they said I had a very stiff jaw, and that I projected from the throat rather than from the ribs and the diaphragm, and... that I also had a rolling gait. I had, because my jaw was stiff and my neck was also stiff, they described it as, when I started acting, you know, everything tensed up, you know. So they spent a long time trying to sort of relax me and allow the sound to come from further down in one's body. So you've got more resonance as the sound comes up from your tummy and, you know, resonates in your ribs rather than starting in your throat and only having your mouth to resonate in. It's a much thinner sound. And it was all very technical and everything, and but very, in the end, very interesting. And you know, we used to do inane exercises, sitting around with our hands on our knees, all facing each other, doing whether the weather be hot or whether the weather be fine, or whether the weather be cold or whether the weather be ooji flip. Whatever the weather, will weather the weather, whether we like it or not. And I spent 7 terms doing this kind of stuff, with whether the weather coming from my stomach and going through my my dark L's, my short tongue, my stiff jaw, my thick neck, my rolling gait, and all the other. I mean, I left feeling like, you know, it was going to be Kenneth Quasimodo Branagh entering the acting profession, you know.
Not exactly a confidence-building exercise, is it?
No, it isn't, but it makes you aware. It makes you aware of certain limitations that you might put on yourself if you're not careful.
Well, do you think all that weather stuff is part of the reason why you have such command over your voice, which I really think you do?
Well, it certainly has made one aware of, clarity. As an adolescent, partly because of what we were talking about earlier, I think partly because of not feeling one quite belonged where I was living, having come from Belfast and a large, extended, working-class family with lots of aunts and uncles and cousins and things, the sense of knowing exactly where one belonged was very strong. And when I was displaced from that particular environment, which many people are in all sorts of different ways all over the world, you often feel at a loss. And one of the things I think it does in adolescence particularly is it you attempt to hide by mumbling. So I spent a lot of my adolescence kind of talking like that, so that when people ask me things, I just say things like that, so that somehow I wouldn't be noticed. So drama school, in a sense, was a chance to re-educate myself and feeling and building that little more confidence, and then being given technical means by which one could express oneself more clearly and actually enjoy doing it. And then as one began to work on Shakespeare and some other classical texts, not only did you have some means by which you could express yourself clearly and technical equipment with which to do it, but you also had rather marvellous words which needed just that, because you can't mumble your way through a Shakespeare speech. You can't, without sufficient breath, do a big chunk of whatever, I don't know, Once More Unto the Breach or any of those things, or indeed convey any of the long, rather complicated thoughts that are sometimes in those plays without the technical equipment. But it was drama school was a sort of rather an awakening through those technical means of a certain part of my personality, which I think had been rather damped down by being displaced from the environment that I felt most comfortable in.
So you think a lot of the coaching that you got and a lot of the vocal coaching that you got carried over into your personality as well as in the roles that you played?
I think so. I mean, it gave one a little more confidence in those basic communicative skills, you know, the fact that, one was encouraged to speak up and to speak clearly and to speak well and to speak articulately. And once you had those, of course, it was rather comforting, because once you find the words, and this is something I think that goes through my work, in fact. One of the reasons I'm interested in doing Shakespeare and trying to allow it to be seen by as many people as possible is that, it for me, it gives me the words and the stories and the emotions, if you like, that are rather helpful expressions in the world at this time, because so much of our language has reduced itself, so much of our reactions to things, to pieces of art or to pieces of popular culture or whatever, are reduced to rather arbitrary superlatives. Everything's, oh, it was wonderful, I thought it was wonderful, I thought it was wonderful, oh, it was terrible, it was terrible. And beyond that, we get stuck.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kenneth Branagh, and he directed and stars in the new movie, Dead Again, and he also directed and starred in the recent adaptation of Henry V. Have you yet directed American actors who haven't had the kind of classical training that you've had and who work perhaps on a more purely intuitive level? And if so, I'm wondering if it's different for you to direct that kind of actor than to direct a classically trained actor.
I find, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages, and there are very positive things in both experiences. A lot of American actors, I think, have what I would describe as a sort of emotional fearlessness when it comes to acting on the screen, and an ability to communicate their performance for and to the camera in a way that is very particular and raw and good and very charged with the appropriate emotion. And I think the very best actors, whether they be American or British, have a combination of that emotional fearlessness, that ability to be very raw and real in the moment, moment by moment. So they don't make a false move, and yet at the same time they can combine a technical awareness of providing that performance and sharing it with an audience, because you have to let them in to what you are feeling and what the scene is about, even if it's just for the camera. There's a way of communicating that, which means a degree of technical awareness, which does not make you a technical actor, but as I say, in the best possible world, combines this, you know, literally they can be heard, they can be understood, they communicate it very technically, assuredly, and yet it remains kind of effortless. So the best ones, and I found that, perfect examples of this in American and in British actors, where their art is the art that hides the art, and it's the best of all and very thrilling to work with. But whoever you work with, you need to create an atmosphere where they can trust you.
We only have a couple of seconds left, so I need to ask you this quickly. In your autobiography, you wrote about how the thing that gave you the most stage fright, at least in front of the class, was singing.
Yeah.
Now, you open Dead Again by singing Billy Strayhorn's Lush Life, a beautiful song. I was wondering if there's any connection there.
No, I mean, there was a direction in the script that meant that I did, in fact, have to sing it. Roman was supposed to sing it, but I enjoyed that. It's much easier when you're singing in a recording studio or even in a prison cell on a film than it is when you're 19 and singing in front of a lot of people and your teachers, and you're singing the most difficult song Purcell ever wrote. Billy Strayhorn had quite a march on Purcell, as far as I'm concerned, so I enjoyed that one.
Kenneth Branagh, it was a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with
us. Thank you.
And Kenneth Branagh directed and stars in the new movie, Dead Again. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.